It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the program, we'll be looking at the situation in Egypt. Mohamed Morsi is out and an interim president is in, but what does this mean for Egypt's already fragile democracy? That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
And we'll kick off this hour with a look at a unique activity that's happening right here in Wisconsin. We recently got a suggestion from a listener who wanted us to talk about historical fencing.
Well, that got us intrigued. So we looked into it and learned that it's part martial art, part historical reenactment, and it's got long swords.
Hey, what's not to love there?
Exactly. Well, to tell us more, we've got Aaron Pennenberg on the phone. He's principal instructor at the Wisconsin Historical Fencing Association. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Well, hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what exactly is historical fencing?
Sure. You know, you mentioned recreationist or, you know, that kind of idea. And really, the acronym HEMA better explains what we're doing. HEMA stands for Historical European Martial Arts. And that idea of martial arts, as it existed in a lot of Asian systems, such as karate and judo, kendo, a lot of lay people think of those things, and they inherently understand kind of what's happening, you know, what's at stake. And really, with the European martial arts, we're looking to revive a lost martial history that existed in the medieval period in Europe that really encompasses everything that the layperson thinks about when they think about karate, kendo, etc.
Now, to the extent that people have seen fencing, it's probably something like maybe foil fencing in the Olympics. I've even done a tiny bit of that. Wasn't very good at it, though. How does historical fencing, this European martial art, differ from what we might see in that kind of arena?
Sure. Well, you're correct in that the historical forms do focus quite a bit on the sword. However, the types and forms of the sword that we focus on are really not the sporting forms or the modern forms that most people are familiar with. You mentioned the foil, and that's absolutely correct. The sport fencing developed out of a sportification of an ancient or former use of these swords for self-defense and for warfare. So what happened is back in the medieval period, before the advent of the firearm, you know, European people are always very practical in nature. So when something better comes along, we kind of jettison our history and go towards that next best thing. And the same basic thing happened in terms of their martial arts forms. When they developed the firearm, it all went towards firearm and, you know, the use of ballistics. However, previous to that, there were forms of martial arts that existed. Now, at that time, there are also masters of these martial arts that were producing manuscripts and materials for reference for the people they were training or the people they were trying to train. And what we're left with are a lot of these period manuscripts, and they're very indigenous. It depends on kind of the region or the country, even though people didn't really identify with countries at that time. But they're very specific in terms of their regional specificity, such as German, Italian, French, etc. So these masters leave behind these materials. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to take a look at these materials and recreate or reconstruct athletically and martially these arts that existed at the time.
Now, what is it that got you interested in this art form?
Yeah, that's a common question. And, you know, I for a long time, I didn't really know. But honestly, I think about 15 years ago or so, I was just looking for a new, unique kind of way to work out. I was kind of fed up with treadmills and lifting weights and this kind of stuff. And I think I just did a general search for, like, European sword, because I thought I'd go out and sling a sword around or something, and maybe I'd come up with something. And I was surprised at the depth of information that was available in terms of using a sword as an activity to work out, to get in shape, and then to use that to strive against another human being and, you know, basically have an experience together. And that's really what this comes down to. It's not like a combat situation where I'm going to go in there and I'm going to hurt my opponent, you know, or I'm going to go in there and embarrass him. It's really a situation in which you both learn together, and much like a dance, as you both get better, you both get a more rich experience out of it, and you both improve and you kind of push each other along. So it has a lot of that built in as well.
Let's talk gear. What kind of swords do you use?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, because right here in Wisconsin, in New Glarus of all places, we have Albion swords. And what they are doing is they're kind of doing the same thing with the actual tools that we are doing with the techniques. You know, in the past, we had people that were making swords, but they weren't really making them based on any pattern from history. They didn't really do a lot of research in terms of what the swords actually, you know, looked like, how heavy they were, what their weight distribution was, how thick does the sword have to be, all that kind of stuff. Albion Swords, working with a Swedish swordsmith named Peter Johansson, went back to these museums, took the actual pieces out of these cases, measured them, you know, inch by inch using micrometers and everything else, and really figured out what these swords were about. And what we found out was some interesting things. So Albion is recreating those swords to high tolerances, high specifications, using high-quality materials. And then we are taking those swords and then applying the actual historical techniques to them, and we're coming up with amazing results and having wonderful insights into that time period.
Well, this sounds really cool to see. If I wanted to go see some people doing this historical fencing, where would I go? How do I find that?
Sure. Well, you know, if you wanted to see it in person, actually, Albion and the Wisconsin Historical Fencing Association is hosting a basic longsword camp in November in New Glarus. There's more information that will be available about that on our website at www.wi-hfa.org. You can also just do a Google search for Wisconsin Historical Fencing, and it would pop up that way. But if you want to go on the internet, you could look at historical European fencing. You know, you could Google that kind of thing, and a bunch of videos would probably pop up. You could also just Google my name, Aaron, with two A's, like Aaron Rodgers, and then Pennenberg, Pennenberg, and a bunch of videos would also pop up.
Now, I got to know, when you're at the movies or watching a TV show representing medieval times and they have combat scenes, are you just kind of clutching your head saying, no, you're getting it all wrong?
You know, I think early on in the development of this, I was kind of doing that. But now you just recognize and realize that, you know, when they're showing that on a movie, they're doing it for purposes not to show you what the actual technique looks like and all that stuff, which actually sometimes can be very boring to watch. It happens so quick and so fast, and it's so subtle that it's very hard to detect or pick up the subtleties of what's happening. But, you know, honestly, they're doing it just to provide a show and add to the storyline and add an element of, you know, suspense and this kind of stuff. So now I can just kind of take it as it comes, and I don't really worry about it too much. But, you know, early on, yeah, that used to bother me a lot.
And one last question on training. You said you're a big fitness guy. My limited experience with the lightest sword known to man, the foil, was that my puny, you know, wimpy arm got really tired after just, you know, a half an hour with that. How do you work up to being able to use a long sword or a broadsword, one of those heavy guys?
Right. You know, the long sword, you can think of it like a baton in a way, because the long sword, once you get it in motion, it's all about using that motion and that impetus to keep the thing in motion and keep working with it. So you actually use your whole body, whereas foiled fencing and sport fencing is very sport specific and uses very specific parts of your body to accomplish certain things. Whereas this really is an all-encompassing martial art. It's not just about the sword. A lot of times we'll end up in wrestling matches, end up on the ground, stuff like that, but you use your whole body to propel this weapon, and it's not heavy either. It's very light. It's 4.5 pounds, and you can get that thing cooking quite fast, but it's almost like, you know, as the thing is moving, as you're inputting this motion into it, it's kind of carrying you into the next position, and you keep building that way, and it almost kind of pulls and propels you, making you more fit, more strong, more fast.
Aaron, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much.
That's Aaron Pennenberg with the Wisconsin Historical Fencing Association. He mentioned seeing videos. We've got links to videos posted on the Central Time Facebook page.
And coming up after the break, we'll take a closer look at the situation in Egypt. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. There's much more Central Time just ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Coming up later in the hour, our guest will tell us about the science of fireworks and the chemistry that gives us the oohs and the ahs of Independence Day.
First, Egypt's military stepped in yesterday to oust President Mohamed Morsi in the midst of major protests in Cairo.
And the big question is, now what? To help answer that, we have Steve Fish. He's a professor and an expert on regime change at the University of California, Berkeley. His books include Are Muslims Distinctive? A Look at the Evidence. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, as we mentioned in the latest news, the Egyptian military appointed an interim president after deposing the last one, Adli Mansour, chairman of the Supreme Constitutional Court. Is this a sign that they want to quickly establish at least the appearance of civilian control of the government?
I think it is. I mean, the fact that they went for a civilian rather than installing one of their own military men does show that they want this to be clear. They want to be clear with everybody that this is not just a typical military coup, and they don't plan on staying in power forever. That said, of course, this guy is very much a creation of the old Mubarak regime. in which the military had a large role. So no one's fooled. I mean, he's definitely someone who's very friendly to the military. But since he's not a career soldier himself, he gives the regime a civilian face.
Well, it's an interesting situation in Egypt. A lot of times when the military takes over, there's a colonel or a general somewhere out there who's ready to run the country for the next 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
The military doesn't seem to want to be, at least publicly, in charge of this place.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point, and I think there's several reasons for that. First of all, Egypt is just very hard to govern right now. People in the streets, a lot of people in the streets now in Cairo, are very excited about this coup because it got rid of a government that they've grown to despise. But the truth is that 6 months from now, a year from now, if the military stays in power, we're probably going to see a rerun of these demonstrations. It's just that they will be against the military. The military has not typically done a great job of governing in Egypt. Remember, the military was in charge between the time of the Arab Spring in the spring of 2011 and the middle of 2012 when Morsi became president and the new parliament was seated. During that little more than a year time, the military became even less popular. They did a pretty lousy job of governing themselves. Now, after a year of Morsi's government, people tend to forget that, and they say, well, anything but Morsi. But the truth is that the military didn't do much better job than he did, and that was fairly recently. So I think a lot of soldiers have come to realize that they really don't, as you say, want to be in the top offices, staffing the top offices with their own officers. They would like a voice, and they'd like a hand in the new government. But I think they don't want to be the public face of the new government.
Well, now, the election of Mohamed Morsi was kind of a coming out party for the Muslim Brotherhood. They'd been an illegal organization, right, for a long time. Now they're in charge. What happened? Did they take it too far? Did Morsi and his colleagues in the Muslim Brotherhood think they had more of a mandate than they did?
Well, they acted like they thought they had more of a mandate, which means they probably did. You know, what they lost track of is the fact that even though they won the parliamentary elections pretty big, they got about half the vote, and then they won the presidential election. But it was close, too. You know, it was 51-49 in the second round. And in the first round of the presidential election, remember, Egypt has two rounds of presidential election if nobody gets a majority. In the first round, they have a runoff. In the first round, about 60% of the vote went to secularist candidates who were not associated with Islamism of any type. And Morsi and another Islamist candidate got about 40%, 42% of the vote, and then he won by a point or two in the second round. So, I mean, it's clearly divided society. Egypt is not, you know, everybody in Egypt is not behind the Islamists, and certainly not behind the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Islamists themselves are very, very diverse. There's this Al-Nur party, which is associated with the harder core so-called Salafists, who are much more orthodox Islamists than the Muslim Brotherhood. And then within the Muslim Brotherhood, there's a lot of diversity as well. But they tended to govern like everybody voted for them. They tended to govern, Morsi in particular, tend to be really imperious. And to try to, like the way he rammed through this his constitution, I think that really ticked a lot of people off. I think they did overplay their hand, as you suggest. At the same time, I think we have to be fair and say that, you know, they didn't get any help from the opposition. The military and a lot of opponents of the Muslim Brotherhood from day one have really not given them much space. Morsi's been fighting against sabotage all along. That's to be expected, I suppose, under these conditions of a divided society. But it's not like Egyptians kind of got behind their new elected leader. In with this so-called deep state, which is the old Mubarak era state apparatus, the bureaucracy, the courts, the army, that Egyptians call this the deep state, still very much a Mubarak-era creation, not really behind Morsi. He probably had an impossible job.
And now we see that the military is arresting key members of the Muslim Brotherhood around the same time that they deposed President Morsi. What now for the Muslim Brotherhood as a political party?
Yeah, I mean, this is really alarming. It's alarming because these folks didn't necessarily do anything wrong except just being in the opposition and being in the government, mm-hmm. and now in opposition to the guys who have come to power. This is really alarming. This is not the way you're supposed to do things. and in anything resembling a democracy. And I hope that President Obama makes it clear, and he did make it clear in his initial statement, that he hoped there would be no arbitrary arrests or prosecution of President Morsi and his colleagues, that the U.S. wasn't going to endorse that. That's not a good thing. Remember during the Mubarak era, between the early 80s and the last, in 2011, the Muslim Brotherhood was, as you suggested in one of your early questions, was in fact persecuted. They were always underground, being hounded by security forces. If there's a return to that, this is only going to deepen divisions in Egyptian society, because the truth is the Muslim Brotherhood still has a lot of popular support. They are not the maximalist crazies among the Islamists. They are a relatively moderate voice, although they are very diverse, of course. And to drive them back underground, to arrest their leaders, and to abuse their rights, their human rights, would be a huge mistake. But it does look right now like the military is kind of reverting to old form by arresting these leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. These are people who haven't been charged with any crimes, and who, I think, by all accounts, haven't necessarily engaged in any criminal activity. And to arrest them early on in this change of government looks bad.
You mentioned briefly President Obama's reaction to this, and I think the White House has expressed a serious concern. I don't remember the exact phrasing about this military takeover. And the United States has been criticized for this, I think, by some of the Egyptian protesters. They're saying, hey, we've got this oppressive president. We're happy to see him gone. U.S. take the side of the people versus this guy who's being ousted. How tricky a position is this for the American government, the American embassy in Cairo?
Yeah, it's really tricky because it's not really clear who the people are. Remember, the people in Egypt elected this guy. And by however narrow a margin, they did elect him president in a free election. They elected his party, the party that came out of his organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, with which he is associated, in the parliamentary elections. And then his constitution, which was very much a product of, you know, what he wanted and was drawn up largely by Muslim Brotherhood folks, passed by 2-1 in referendum. So, I mean, what we see now are street demonstrations where it appears that there's a lot of opposition to Morsi and to the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's certainly true. But, you know, there hasn't been a vote or referendum in recent months. We don't know what public opinion is on this. We do know that a lot of highly motivated people who are good organizers were able to muster some very large demonstrations. We do know that Morsi has become less popular than he was before. But it's very hard to say, okay, the people spoke a couple of days ago, or this people spoke yesterday when Morsi was thrown out of power, because the people elected this guy, you know, just a little more than a year ago. So it's just not clear who the people are in Egypt right now. It is clear it's a divided society and that it's hard to make that assessment.
Now, with the appointment of this interim president, there's a notion that, yeah, we're going to have more elections soon. Is another round of elections going to make people any happier than the last one did?
Egypt has become really difficult to govern. There's no doubt that it's a divided society. The economy is in a tailspin. They're suffering from many years of some pretty questionable economic policies. They're reliant on tourism, which isn't going to bounce back anytime soon, as long as stability doesn't return to the country, political stability. You know, this is a very hard place to govern, and I don't see either the military taking power or another election solving Egypt's problems of governability. It will give the people a chance to register their will again, and it'll lead to a change of government of some sort. But I think Egypt is going to be a real piece of work to govern for many years to come.
Also in the news today, the leader of Turkey criticized Egypt's military for this takeover. Are you still there, Steve Fish? I thought not. We'll try to get him back on the air. He's going to join us again after the news break. And in part two of the interview, after answering that last question, we're going to broaden things out a little bit. And he studies regime change a lot. And we're going to talk about what it takes to go from revolution to what we might recognize as a functioning democratic government with popular participation. That's coming up after the news. And then I'll remind you that we're talking to Steve Fish. He's professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. He'll join us again coming up after the news break. He's an expert on regime change, which we're going to get into. We're looking at the latest news from Egypt, where the military has overthrown the president amid protests, replaced him today with an interim president. We're going to pick up that conversation with him after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And don't forget, you can keep up with us on the Central Time Facebook page. Drop us a note. Let us know what you're thinking. And give us suggestions as well. We're looking for suggestions on Curious Wisconsin, things you might be curious about in the state and you've always wanted to know. This is your chance. We can get to those on the Central Time Facebook page.
And one thing I'm curious about is how fireworks work. And we're going to talk about the science of those 4th of July displays coming up in about 15 minutes after we're done talking about Egypt. So stick around. Lots more to come here on Central Time. Thanks so much for listening on this holiday. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We'll continue our discussion now about the latest news from Egypt with Steve Fish of the University of California, Berkeley. Steve, just before the break, I was asking in the news today, the leader of Turkey had reacted very negatively to the military takeover. He's in a country with a similar position, a strong military that sometimes is a check on what goes on in the government. What do you make of that response?
Well, yes, I think it is what we would expect from the Turkish prime minister, because he is, as you mentioned, a civilian leader, an elected leader in a country that has a military that traditionally has had a big hand in politics. And one of his big accomplishments, that is the prime minister of Turkey, has been to marginalize the military, to push it out of politics over the last decade. So this is the kind of thing happening in a neighboring country that he can, of course, find alarming.
Now, I wanted to broaden things out a little bit to bigger concepts of regime change. It's, of course, Independence Day here in the United States, and maybe we have a quick and easy view, maybe shortening our history a little, but you throw out the guys you don't like, little time passes, you got a democracy, everybody's happy. It doesn't usually work that way, does it?
No, it doesn't. It takes a long time sometimes to get to democracy. There are cases where countries have undergone, in some sense, you know, what we could call instant democratization. Poland did after the Soviet Empire fell apart. You can think of some cases in Latin America that underwent very fast democratization, Argentina, Chile, after the dictators were thrown out. But many of those countries had a history of democracy that went back and predated the period of the dictatorship that they were overthrowing. These were cases of re-democratization in a place like Chile or Argentina. The people had some experience, Argentines and Chileans, with democracy many decades before. In a place like Egypt, we're not talking about re-democratization. We're talking about democratization for the first time. And in cases like that, sometimes it's especially hard to get to democracy, and it requires a lot of trial and error. One of the encouraging things about Egypt is that the people have stayed so engaged in politics, very different than a case like Russia, for example, where people fatigued quite quickly and really don't get into the streets. They really don't organize to resist dictatorship with the same enthusiasm that Egyptians have done, or with the same kind of sustained interest in it. And consequently, that makes it easier for a Putin to come to power and, you know, push people aside and emasculate their rights and run roughshod over them and make himself a dictatorship. It's clear now in Egypt that even though people don't have much experience with democracy, and even though throwing somebody out of power in a military coup is not a democratic way to remove them, that there's a lot of anti-authoritarian sentiment in Egypt. When any leader, democratically elected or not, begins to overstep his powers, people are going to react.
Now, you've studied whether Muslim cultures, Muslim styles of government are distinctively different. Is there something about a place like Egypt, a primarily, of course, Muslim country, that makes it less conducive to democracy, or is that just a bad stereotype?
That's a good question. I find in my work that predominantly Muslim countries at the moment do tend to lag behind on democracy, but I also find that that's changing, and that we don't have any good explanations rooted in anything about Islamic culture, to explain that, which makes me hopeful that, you know, 20 years from now, we will treat this notion that Muslims are resistant to democracy the same way we treat the old notion that was common when I was growing up. And remember, even in the 70s and 80s, people used to say that Catholic countries were not being Catholic was not conducive to democracy. They looked around the world, and Eastern Europe were dictatorships, Latin America, the Philippines, Southern Europe even, countries had non-democratic governments, and people thought, you know, you got to be Protestant to be a democracy. The northwest corner of the world, northwestern Europe and America, that's really the only place democracy can thrive. Well, we now look at that and chuckle at those ideas, because Eastern Europe and all of Latin America, most of it, the Philippines and many other Catholic countries are already democracies. I think 20 years from now, we might look back and say the same thing about Islam. I can't find anything about Islam itself that is contrary to democracy. And so I'm pretty hopeful that this correlation is going to wash away in coming decades.
You know, watching other countries from our vantage here in the United States, I think there's an assumption that they're sort of all striving to do things the right way, and everybody wants eventually to get some sort of elected representative government. Is that really how people are thinking, whether we're talking about Egypt or Russia or anywhere else that doesn't have that kind of government now?
That's a very good question, and one of the big questions that we study in political science, right, is, I mean, do people, you know, we assume that people want democracy, they want to rule themselves, but do they really, and then how do they understand democracy? A Chinese understands democracy differently than a Russian, differently than an Egyptian, differently from an American, and, you know, it's all rooted in our national traditions. When you talk to a Chinese about democracy, they're much more likely to think in terms of justice and in terms of clean government as opposed to corrupt government. When you talk to an American about democracy, we tend to think about rights, liberal rights. But democracy ultimately is about self-rule. It's about ruling either directly or in the modern world, of course, through our representatives, because there's too many of us to have direct democracy. And, you know, people have different views on this. I think it's safe to say that most Egyptians like the idea of representative government, but how you get there and what that means, and then what happens if you don't like your elected representatives, is a question over which a lot of people are going to disagree.
It seems like the big challenge is always the stakes. If you win, can you run roughshod over the people you beat? If you lose, are the stakes so high that you're better off protesting, rebelling, having a coup, than just taking what the winners give you?
Right. That's one of the big old questions in democracy, is does the elected majority have the right to rule alone? And, you know, from Morsi's point of view, look, his party won the presidency and the parliamentary elections and won the constitutional referendum big. So he had a mandate to govern. His mandate was every bit as big as, you know, the Republican Party in the United States during the Bush administration and during the congressional elections that were held in 2002. You know, look, it's very difficult to say, you know, in the abstract, whether an elected majority has a right to run roughshod over the minority. It kind of depends on what they're doing. In a case like Egypt, there's no history of constitutional checks on executive power to speak of. And what that means is that people are used to whoever the main man is being, whoever the main man is gets whatever he wants, whether that be Mubarak or Morsi and so on. But after the Arab Spring, people woke up, and they were probably already awake. They were just being repressed. But they decided that, you know, they wanted to run affairs themselves. And when Morsi started acting like a pharaoh again, they decided to throw him out. That said, again, this is not a democratic way to do it. In a democracy, you wait until the next elections. You put your guys up, you throw the bums out. You don't do it in a military coup a year after the election that brought to power somebody you decided you didn't like.
To wrap things up, I know you can't predict the future, but where do you see things going next? Are we going to see another shot at a constitution or a civil war or some point in between?
I think we'll see another shot at a constitution. I think the fact that the last constitution was approved in referendum by a large margin means that it's going to be hard for the next constitution to be legitimate unless the referendum is really clean and fair, or unless it's passed by a constitutional assembly that's elected by the people in free and fair elections. We're also going to see probably the military maintain its tutelage over politics for at least a year. They'll put civilians up into the top positions, as they already have done with the interim president, as you mentioned. But the military is still going to be in power for some time. Now, whether the people are back in the streets a year from now and we see another rerun of this, or whether, in fact, Egypt can achieve some sort of long-term political stability without a rerun of these events depends, I think, in part on how free and fair the upcoming elections are, when elections are held, and also, let's face it, just on the competence of government. The Morsi government was democratically elected, but it did a miserable job of governing. Not only did he overreach, but he also just proved to be a pretty incompetent administrator, and the Muslim Brotherhood did writ large. So it's going to be interesting to see whether Egypt's new rulers are a little bit better at public administration than the Muslim Brotherhood. A lot will ride on that as well.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
That was Steve Fish. He's a political scientist at the University of California, Berkeley.
Coming up next on Central Time, we'll find out what makes fireworks snap, crackle, and pop, and gives them their color and shape. Our guests will share some of the science behind the fireworks displays. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, it's not that I don't love being on the air right now, but I'm already jonesing for the fireworks coming on tonight.
You want to get out of here early and catch a good seat?
Is that a possibility?
Well, no. But I'm going to try to catch Monona's fireworks show tonight. But I always wonder, how do these things work? How do you get those amazing colors and shapes and sounds?
Well, it's a good question. And here to school us on pyrotechnics is freelance science writer Adam Hadhazy. He's working on a series for LiveScience.com called The Science of Summer. And his latest article breaks down how fireworks do their thing. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. It's very nice to be with you today.
So how would you define a firework? What is it exactly?
So the most common type of firework that we see and we will be seeing just in a few hours, I, like you guys, am also very excited for the show tonight. The most common type, it's called an aerial shell. And this is essentially a canister that is stuffed with gunpowder or a black powder, as it's often more technically called, and it's all about how that gunpowder is shaped in there that really determines, you know, how high the firework is going to go, when it's going to explode, and how big the explosion will be, that sort of thing.
So the big question for me is always, how do they make it, you know, it's an explosion, how do they make it explode in a different color?
So, right, the colors, what determines that the aerial shell is packed with what they call stars, and these are kind of like little black marbles, I've heard them described as. And these will have different chemical compositions, and different chemical elements produce different colors. Some of the easiest ones are red. They typically use strontium. Green is done with barium. Sodium gives you a sort of a strong yellow or gold color. Magnesium makes white light, and so various combinations of these can be used to create different colors, and you can put you can get different colors out of the same star, actually. You can sort of put layers of the chemical elements, kind of like a gobstopper candy. So what happens is that, just to walk through the process, when the firework explodes and the black powder blows up, it also sets these little stars on fire, and as they burn, that's when the color is released. So for the layered ones, as they burn, each layer burns, you'll get different colors.
I feel like I've been seeing different colors as the years go by. What's the deal with you know, which ones are easiest and which colors are newest?
They have been making some progress there. There's apparently you know, fireworks as an invention as such are, you know, quite old. The reckoning is that they were the first examples, they believe, of them being used is the Chinese used them back in the 7th century BCE. So fireworks have been around a while, but they still continue to innovate and come up with new ways of, you know, making colors and shapes. Some of the colors that are newer, I understand that blue is one of the trickier colors to make. They will involve chlorine compounds and copper with that, And there is an aquamarine color that apparently is a newer one that they've been able to pull off. So, indeed, we're going to keep seeing, you know, as they keep playing around with these things, we're going to keep seeing new colors, shapes, all that kind of stuff.
Well, let's get into sound now, because, you know, watching the fireworks at a distance yesterday, the Madison fireworks, some of them are, you know, that popcorn sound, and some of them it sounds like somebody just installed a bass amp in my chest. What makes the difference there?
So some of what's going on there is, and this, again, boils down to, you know, what the ingredients are, basically. If you have really loud, noisy, or crackling firecrackers, there's probably something in there called flash powder. There's various kinds of flash powders. One is, for example, is a magnesium perchlorate, and this burns rather quickly. And so as it burns quickly, it's going to, you know, generate a lot of sound. To get something like a sparkling effect, some titanium apparently is useful for that. So, but again, it's all about you know, different chemical compounds will give you different, you know, different size bangs, basically. And you know, fireworks manufacturers certainly know what they're doing when they put that
At the fireworks display that I normally go to, often in between, you know, the ones that are your classic shooting star ones, there'll be these loud just booms, which are just flashes of light and a super loud boom. And I've always wondered, are those duds or are those intentional fireworks?
I'm not entirely sure. That I think I know the ones that you're talking about. I'm pretty sure that they mean to do that. I don't think there are a whole lot of duds, but I certainly know sometimes you'll see one if you're close enough to the barge or wherever they're being launched. Usually, I've certainly seen one go up and you're kind of watching it, and then nothing happens, and you're like, okay, that one didn't make it. But for those big bass booms you're talking about, yeah, I like those a lot. It's also a possibility that you may be getting, depending on where it is, maybe some kind of, echo, you know, sound reflection kind of thing, you know, so it's happening, seeming to happen so far after the fact.
Now, a lot of displays, I get, like, the streaming down, I get when there's kind of circles, but it seems like each year it gets more funky with smiley faces or hearts, or my kids remember the American flag, like a rectangle last year. Now, how do they make them come out in shapes like that?
Yeah, so that's really definitely an area of active innovation, and that's something that really excites me whenever I see a new shape. You know, I can remember, you know, first seeing a smiley face some years back, and I do remember recently seeing what was a cube. I've been lucky in that I've gotten to go to some of the biggest fireworks displays in the U.S. I live in New York City, and so I've seen them there a couple times, which has been excellent. And a couple years ago, I got to check out the show in Washington, D.C., you know, which is one of the biggest shows around. And so when it comes to these shapes, the main concept is essentially going back to those stars. The way they place them in the aerial shell, it's just all about clever positioning. Basically, if you want to make a instead of just having, you know, packing stars in there willy nilly and then going off in the sort of more typical the stars are the sort of glowing dots you see, of course, you know, when the firework goes off. Instead of just having the stars and therefore the glowing dots be everywhere, if you pack them, for example, into a ring shape in the shell, when the shell explodes, then you're going to get a ring. If you want an arc, then just do a semicircle, just do half that. And so when it comes to things like smiley faces or, you know, Saturns, heart shapes, it's just all about getting the placement right. And there are a couple tricks to that. You can put some inert, non-burning material around the stars so that it takes a little while for the explosion to get to certain stars, and when they go out, that they will light up later than some of the other than some of the other ones will. So there's a number of ways to try to, you know, coax these shapes out of the explosions, and this is again something that you know, fireworks manufacturers continue to keep working on. And so, you know, we should keep seeing new exciting things as the years go on.
It seems like it'll be a lot of fun to be on the fireworks testing range, and you've packed it this way. Am I going to get the hexagon shape that I've been trying for or whatever. Shoot it up. No, more of a circle. Tweak the next one. I could see spending all night playing around with that.
There's certainly, you know, for all of us, I think why a lot of us like fireworks and certainly why people like making them. Yeah, I mean, you know, making things blow up is obviously a bit of fun. You know, got to be safe about it, of course, but, you know, from a distance and done right, you know, it's kind of hard not to smile at it.
Do you have a sense, Adam, of some of the stuff that firework makers really want to do, but technology won't allow them yet? Maybe like the swooping dragons that Gandalf shoots off in Lord of the Rings? I would love to see that.
That is a fantastic idea. And I'm sure if that could be pulled off, that's something they would definitely be gunning for. It's something I would certainly like to see. And some Gandalf fireworks would be excellent. That's actually a really good question. That from having done this article, I'm certainly looking to learn more about this, and you know, certainly looking to talk to more to manufacturers to find out what is sort of their, you know, dream firework, if they would be willing to share. Okay, yeah, we're trying to make something like this. You know, I'm not sure if they'd be willing to share some of the trade secrets as yet, but you know, hopefully with the way things are going, you know, given just kind of the general pace of, you know, technological innovation and advancement and so forth. And you know, fire, as great as fireworks are now, you know, they're still not that different from as they've been, you know, back in the day, going back centuries. There probably is still a lot of room for, you know, improvement yet. And, you know, hopefully someday we do get something like a, you know, giant Roman candle swooping dragon like we see a Gandalf pull off.
I'm there.
I've got this picture now of, like, at, you know, behind the scenes of the fireworks factory, and there's Sir Ian McKellen, you know, protecting his magical secrets of this year's new firework innovations.
Yeah, that I certainly think there is maybe a bit of a, you know, secret arms race, perhaps, between the manufacturers trying to come up with something new. Of course, you know, as soon as it's out there and someone sees it, and you know, it you know, blows up for, you know, millions of people to see, then the, you know, then the secret's out, of course. So, you know, hopefully there is still, you know, a lot more left to be done here, and, you know, maybe we'll see something tonight that we haven't seen before.
You know, it's interesting that historically they're not that different than they were from, you know, the ancient Chinese fireworks. So you could say, geez, why haven't we made more progress? But on the other hand, there's something kind of cool about that we're seeing something that's that old and we still get as much of a bang out of it as we used
so
to
speak.
Do.
Yeah.
This is something that's been entertaining, you know, generations of people, you know, for millennia now, you know, so that's just kind of a cool thought.
And Adam, what fireworks show are you going to see tonight?
So I'm going to be here in hometown Annapolis, Maryland. They actually put on a pretty good show here by the Naval Academy. So I've seen that a bunch and looking forward to seeing it again.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fun to talk fireworks.
All right, guys. It was fun talking to you as well. And it'll be fun tonight, you know, seeing everything blow up in the sky.
That was Adam Hadhazy. He's a freelance science writer. We've got a link to his series on the science of summer on our Facebook page. And while you're there, tell us, where did you go if you went earlier in the week, or where are you going to go to see fireworks in Wisconsin or beyond? That's the Central Time Facebook page.
Also, be cool to hear about what your favorite fireworks are.
Point.
What are the ones that you look forward to? I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.